Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for coming. My name is Karen Von Hippel. I'm the co-director of the PCR project here at CSIS, along with Rick Barton, who many of you know, working closely, obviously, with Shannon Hayden, who many of you know, who's here, who's really heading up this project. Hey. Today, let me just give you a little bit of background on the project before I introduce Professor Mansfield. We've been working for a couple years now, really, on the issue of religion and foreign policy and trying to improve our understanding of the role of religion and foreign policy. And many of you in the room have been at a number of our events. We are funded by the Luce Foundation, Plowshares, and Carnegie, so we're really grateful for their support for our work. And we've been do you have the copy of the report, actually? I could just show. Well, anyway, it's all right. We have a report that many of you have seen. You can download it on the web. It came out in 2007, and now for the next few years, we're working on implementing some of the recommendations from the report. One is a series of events we've been sponsoring on poorly understood religious leaders. So we have had events on Muqtada al-Sadr. We had an event on Khamenei recently, and we're hoping to do one soon on Hassan Nasrallah about how do we improve our understanding of these figures when we go into conflict zones. Who are these people? And what roles do they play in these societies? Another area we're looking at is how to encourage a broad public discussion on the role of religion. People are very afraid of it, and they're afraid of talking about it. So we're trying to invite a number of prominent politicians and others to really help address these issues. And then, of course, the third area, and the reason we're so delighted to have Professor Mansfield here today is really looking to provide greater legal clarity. There are so many thorny issues about working on religion and with religious actors and organizations and abroad in conflict zones. And Professor Mansfield, as most of you know, who is a professor emeritus at Harvard Law School, he is really the first scholar to really focus on this issue, the extraterritorial application of church and state. He's really probably America's preeminent scholar on this issue. So we're really delighted and grateful that he is here today with us with such a small distinguished group of other scholars and practitioners in the room to address this issue. He'll speak for about 20 minutes on the subject, and then we'll open it up for discussion. I'm just thinking, though, maybe because we're not a big group, we can quickly go around and just introduce ourselves and say where we work. If you could speak into the microphone, that would be great, because we're recording this, and it will be put online in a few days. So can we just go around the room really quickly? Obviously, you don't need to introduce yourself, but okay.
I'm Robert Van Leeuwen. I'm a senior associate with CSIS.
I'm Jared Rage, and I work at CSIS in the president's office.
Bob Tuttle from George Washington Law School.
Lauren Willard in the Human Rights and Security Department at CSIS.
Rocio Mercado, Pickering Fellow, U.S. Department of State.
I'm Alexander Cohen from the Institute of World Politics.
Michael Thomas. I'm a retired lawyer and went back to school and got some degrees in international relations and wrote a book on American policy toward Israel.
Maria Banda, student at Harvard Law School and intern at the Canadian Embassy.
Patrick Moore, the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy.
Emily Stiles, an intern at USAID.
Robert Murphy of Creative Associates.
Joe Reeder, I'm with the Greenberg Traurig Law Firm. I was in the Clinton administration and have worked very closely with Cardinal McCarrick on his outreach to Iran.
Jim Wooten, I'm on the board of the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy.
Maria Luisa Mansfield, I'm his wife. I have a PhD in Islamic art and architecture.
I'm Caroline Gross from USAID General Counsel's Office.
I'm Wendell Ballou, a lawyer. I represent an association of Islamic charities called the Friends of Charities Association.
I'm Leonard Oberlander, formerly U.S. Government, retired, now independent consultant and member of Board of Trustees of People to People International and member of the International Liaison Committee of People to People International.
Legal counsel.
I'm Ashley Deeks, a visiting fellow here in the International Security Policy at CSIS.
I'm Shannon Hayden at CSIS.
Okay, now we will get greater clarity. So, Professor Mansfield, please, thank you very much.
So,
I'm going to start talking about the recent Supreme Court decisions, which I plan to persuade you are relevant to the applicability of the religion clauses abroad. They've given me an opportunity to study these recent decisions. So the first case I'm talking about is the Boumediene case. This case involved alien detainees in Guantanamo who were seeking habeas corpus and asserting a constitutional right to fair procedure. The court held that they had a constitutional right to habeas corpus to examine the legality of their detention. Congress had violated their constitutional right by depriving the federal courts of jurisdiction to issue writs of habeas corpus and providing an inadequate substitute. The Competent Status Review Tribunals, acronym is CSRT, were inadequate because the petitioners were not allowed to access to classified information. These tribunals were authorized to use hearsay, and the petitioners had no lawyers. Under the circumstances, there was too much risk of error in the classification as to an unlawful combatant or a lawful combatant. The review provided in the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Appeals did not make up for the deficiencies because it was too limited in various respects. The court measured the adequacy of the process by what habeas corpus courts had historically been able to do. The upshot was that Congress had violated the suspension clause. There's a particular provision in Article 1 dealing with the suspension of habeas corpus, which may only be suspended in times of invasion or insurrection. One might argue that 9/11 was an invasion, but the government didn't argue that. Although in the lease that the U.S. had obtained from an independent Cuba following the Spanish-American War, Cuba retained what they called ultimate sovereignty. The court stressed the fact of de facto control. The Cuban courts did not claim jurisdiction over Guantanamo, and probably the only law applicable in Guantanamo was United States law. The court had an earlier case treated Guantanamo as a part of the United States because of this de facto control. Now, the second case, the MUNAF case, M-U-N-A-F, this was a case, the Boumediene case, they were all aliens, and Congress had not suspended the writ of habeas corpus or provided this inadequate substitute in the case of citizens. This provision, the habeas corpus statute was fully applicable to U.S. citizens. This case involved a U.S. citizen, the MUNAF case, whom the U.S. military were detaining in Iraq and proposing to turn over to the Iraqis for prosecution for unlawful insurgency. As we saw in the trial of Saddam Hussein, there are Iraqi courts, whatever one may think about them, and there is an Iraqi law which may distinguish it from Guantanamo. This citizen, this U.S. citizen, had a right to habeas corpus under the statute. The removal of federal court jurisdiction pertained only to aliens. But then he had no constitutional right. He had a right to habeas corpus. But he had no constitutional right not to be turned over to the Iraqis for prosecution. In this case, the court stressed that Iraq is a sovereign nation with a right to prosecute crimes committed within its borders. Thus, the court stressed the need for comity, respect for a sovereign nation, among nations. So as I see it, there's a tension, I wouldn't say a direct conflict, between these two cases, but certainly a tension. The U.S., by its invasion of Iraq, replaced one regime with another. Some observers believe that the present Iraqi government would collapse if the U.S. withdrew its troops, even though the Iraq government has recently called for a timetable for withdrawal, but has called for immediate withdrawal. So does it not have the same de facto control over Iraq that it does in Guantanamo? That's what I'm seeing as a tension between these two cases. What is the significance of a distinction between aliens and citizens? Is an NGO based in the United States that has programs abroad to be treated, which category does it go into? Is it more like a citizen or is it more like an alien? Arguments can be made either way. In an earlier Supreme Court decision relating to the Fourth Amendment, an alien who had no prior connection with the United States, his house was searched in Mexico, and he was then kidnapped, abducted to the United States, and stood trial for drug dealings in California. Now, the Supreme Court in that case, the Verdugo case, held that the search, the violation of the Fourth Amendment had occurred in Mexico, even though it was authorized by officials in Washington. In dictum, it suggested that it might have made a difference if the owner had been a U.S. citizen. Now, aliens in the United States have many constitutional rights. The right to due process. They have a wide range of constitutional rights, the right not to incriminate themselves. And the only rights they do not have is to hold office or to vote, political rights. Another statement about addressing the issue, what's the significance of the citizenship versus the alienage? What's the significance of that distinction? Boumediene does not hold that aliens have no constitutional rights abroad. It only holds that in a situation where the U.S. has de facto control, they do have constitutional rights. So the Guantanamo is treated as part of the United States for these purposes. Now, the insular cases, which occurred after the Spanish-American War in the late and early 20th century, it depends what constitutional right is asserted. Here, for the first time, the United States began to acquire an empire. And the court drew this distinction between incorporated territories or possessions and unincorporated territories and possessions. So when the Bill of Rights was not fully applicable to unincorporated territories, whereas it was fully applicable to the incorporated territories. So for the first time, the United States had possessions that had a totally different culture, including a legal culture, and were people in Puerto Rico, for instance, or in Cuba subject to or have the benefit of or subject to, depending on how you look at it, de jure trial? And out of this emerged a decision, a theory that some fundamental rights would always be applicable, even in unincorporated territories, whereas the full panoply of the Bill of Rights, the jury trial, would not be applicable. So it depends what part of the Bill of Rights we're talking about, whether it's applicable outside the United States, whether it's applicable extraterritorially. And so I would think in Guantanamo, for instance, which surely is an incorporated territory because of the de facto control, that the Bill of Rights would be fully applicable. So the Free Exercise Clause and the Non-Establishment Clause would be fully applicable. And perhaps even in Iraqi prison controlled entirely by the United States, the Bill of Rights would be applicable, but to an alien, come back to that distinction, to an alien or a citizen. So the main point is that certain fundamentals, and that's the question, what is a fundamental, will always be applicable to the United States government wherever it's has de facto control. Well, since I wrote my DePaul article, much has changed. I'm now talking about the religion clauses. The focus now is on the religion clauses. Much has changed in the court's interpretation of both the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. In regard to the Free Exercise Clause, whereas before, under what's called the Sherbert test, you had to have a compelling state interest to override a conflict with a person's religion. After the Smith decision in 1990, as I recall, that Free Exercise Clause was turned into a kind of a non-discrimination provision. In other words, if you targeted or picked out religion for some burden or disadvantage, then only would you have a free exercise claim. Now, so as referred to, the court refers to targeting religion. Now, Congress responded with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and they attempted to reverse the Supreme Court's ruling in regard to the Constitution, but of course they only passed a statute. So under the statute, they restored the Sherbert test. You had to have a compelling state interest. So there's been this tug of war between the Supreme Court and Congress, Justice Scalia cutting down or reducing the significance of the Free Exercise Clause, and Congress always responding by shoring it up again, trying to restore as best to the extent of their power to restore it, that the Sherbert test, reinstate the Sherbert test. And there's a recent statute, fairly recent statute, called the Institutionalized Person and Land Use thing, Rule LUIPA, restoring the Sherbert test, hanging on the Commerce Clause, dependent upon the Commerce Clause, in various prisons, for instance, now the applicability of either the Religious Freedom Restoration Act or this RULIPA Act to Guantanamo, prisons in Guantanamo, and the applicability to U.S. prisons in Iraq. That's an unanswered question. We don't know the answer to that question. But maybe, because we're not talking about the applicability of the Constitution, the religion clause of the Constitution, to Guantanamo or Iraq. We're talking about the applicability of a statute, these special statutes, and whether they include rights to, they confer rights on aliens. It says nothing about the distinction between aliens and citizens in either of these statutes. So in my DePaul article, I suggested, depending on the history, that the Free Exercise Clause was more fundamental. Because if you free exercise was guaranteed in some of the early colonial charters. They specifically referred to the, for instance, Maryland, specifically referred to the free exercise of religion guaranteed to all people. And that was long before laws against establishment. So I said that gives me some ground to say the free exercise idea is a more fundamental idea for a more fundamental freedom. You can have, let's say, in Britain now, a free exercise of religion, even though you've got an established church, the Anglican Church. So just as a matter of history, that one thing has followed another. But now the Smith case has deprived me of that argument because really the Smith case has substantially eliminated the significance of the Free Exercise Clause, except where they target religion, which is very rarely the case. now, here's the tie-in between the Munaf case and the religion cases. The second case I've been talking about here. Does it matter what Iraq was intending to prosecute him for? I would think so. The Americans wanted authority to turn him over to the Iraqis for prosecution for unlawful sedition. But supposing they wanted to turn him over to the Iraqis for prosecution under an Iraqi law of forbidding blasphemy or forbidding for attending an unlawful worship service. Would he have a constitutional right as a citizen not to be turned over? I'm emphasizing the connection between the nature of the or the subject of the Bill of Rights, the guarantee of rights, and whether or not he can be turned over. even if he's an alien, could he be turned over to the Iraqis for prosecution for blasphemy? Well, one thing is, one remark might be made is that often the United States courts will not enforce foreign judgments because they conflict with public policy, with some fundamental public policy. Yesterday I was talking to a group of Muslim women lawyers, and that the issue there was a marriage, a contract entered into in Pakistan between two Pakistanis, and whether the marriage contract was then the wife sued for a divorce in a Maryland court. They moved to the United States. He had a job at the World Bank, and after 20 years of residence in Maryland, she sought a divorce. He then went into the Pakistan embassy and delivered what's called a talaq, which needs no judicial procedure. And so the issue was, the real question was whether the wife could reach his World Bank pension, which was valued at $1 million. And the Maryland court refused to be bound by the Islamic marriage contract entered into in Pakistan because it conflicted with a basic fundamental Maryland public policy. Now, another point to be made is that extradition cases, as I said, aliens have many rights in the United States, many constitutional rights in the United States. And extradition cases usually, let's say, they won't extradite you to a nation that practiced torture or would prosecute you for blasphemy or prosecute you for attending an unlawful religious service. So you put together those two, the rejection of the enforcement of foreign judgments on the ground of public policy and the extradition case, and my argument would be the Iraqis, the United States should not turn him over to for prosecution under the law of blasphemy, or even though he's an alien. Well, maybe I've talked too long. The Munaf case, just one more point before I stop talking, touches upon the subject of torture. And the majority opinion says the petitioner was claiming he would be tortured in Iraqi jails if they turned him over. And the government argued that, well, we've got an executive determination that the Iraqis do not torture these days. And Justice Souter concurred in the judgment only on the understanding that if there was a significant probability of torture, he had a constitutional right, at least a citizen had a constitutional right, not to be turned over under those circumstances. And he would not be bound by the executive branch's determination that there was no property. If there was a substantial basis for believing that he would be tortured, then they should not turn him over to the Iraqis. Now, I'm going to argue that the torture issue, the likelihood of torture, should be assimilated to the blasphemy or attending unlawful worship service. There's a difference. There's a difference, of course. But in terms of fundamental ideas, fundamental values that the United States adheres to wherever it operates, have I not a good argument that blasphemy, prosecution for blasphemy, or attending an unlawful worship service would be on an equal footing with torture? That's my proposition. Have I talked long enough?
It's really
too long.
Well, it's been fascinating. I think we will continue the conversation. These are extraordinarily complex and rich issues that we're all trying to navigate through right now. Let me open the floor and see if we have any questions, and then we'll try to keep your questions short so we can give the professor time to respond. Thank you.
Professor, you didn't mention the term, as I recall, political asylum. And is the latter descriptions that you made related where the government makes an executive determination regarding the charges, for instance, in Iraq. Were you referring to the ability to request political asylum based on the belief of the person that if they do go back, there's reasonable belief that they would be tortured or harmed?
Well, my understanding is that the immigration authorities make a determination of fact. Somebody may fear they may be tortured, but don't they have to make a showing by some evidence of a probability that they would be persecuted or tortured? I've read a number of cases about this, asylum cases. But you raised two different points, really. One is whether you're bound by an executive determination that they will not be tortured. And the other is whether there's an objective or subjective standard. And my understanding is that the subjective fear of torture, of prosecution for blasphemy, for instance, in my example, would not be enough.
Professor Mansfield, you didn't talk about the Establishment Clause and the extent to which either of these cases may touch on the extraterritorial application of the Establishment Clause. And I wonder whether your thoughts on that have changed since the DePaul piece.
Which is right here, by the way.
Yeah. Well, as you're aware, Professor Tuttle, right? The Establishment Clause, the jurisprudence under the Establishment Clause has been greatly relaxed. So it's going to be hard to make out a violation of the Establishment Clause in light of the recent decisions. The breadth of entitlement under a statute can be so wide that you can pay, the government can pay even for seminary training if the options are sufficiently wide. He could have gone to this place, he could have gone to that, but he chose the ministry, chose the training of the ministry. And also the pervasively sectarian quality of an educational institution, that has faded away. The prohibition against aiding a pervasively sectarian institution fading away. That was part of the demand. These pervasively sectarian institutions could not there could be no effective separation between religion and the and the secular and religious components in these pervasively sectarian issues. So that my understanding is that's all been pushed to one side. Well, the seminary example, which is surely pervasively sectarian, if you have a broad enough program, you can aid seminary training. And the voucher cases, the voucher case, the upholding of the voucher cases, state statutes that provided vouchers to go to, well, they go into parochial schools. And so a lot has changed in regard to the Establishment Clause. What clearly was not allowed before has now been allowed. And it would be, if you, a fortiori, I would say, in extraterritorial application, it would be very hard to come up with a program that would be vulnerable under the Establishment Clause. Now, the other recent decision, I think in last term, 2007, about standing, the Hein case, H-E-I-N, the Hein case drew a distinction between the earlier cases which upheld taxpayer standing to attack a federal program that challenged under the Establishment Clause because the court distinguished it from the general rule that federal taxpayers do not have standing. Because how else will the Establishment Clause be enforced unless the taxpayer? So they saw a linkage between the taxes and the establishment providing funds for different friends. So how else? That was their argument. But in the Hein case, the 2007 case, they said, well, you've got to be attacking an act of Congress on its face. Where there's any administrative discretion as to what programs shall be allowed, what programs shall be tapped, then the taxpayers do not have standing in that case. So that's a significant drawback. So both the greater flexibility under the Establishment Clause and the reduced standing. But you could have, let's say, a parent in a school in Indonesia would have standing. A child, they're living in Indonesia, a United States citizen is living in Indonesia, and they send their child to a school, an Islamic school, would have standing to object to the violation of the Establishment Clause, and standing only, I'm talking only standing, but would the program violate the Establishment Clause as such, given the extraterritorial location of it and the compelling state interest. Now, this is strange, because once the compelling state interest disappeared under the Free Exercise Clause, it has tended to reappear under the Establishment Clause. I've read a number of decisions arguing that there's a compelling state interest. And, to my point of view, is that it has no business in the Establishment Clause analysis, a compelling state interest. The framers decided we don't want an establishment. Particularly, we don't want tax monies flowing to support a church. My argument is there's an inflexible character to the establishment, whatever an establishment is. and so you have no business bringing in this compelling state interest into a state. There's a flat prohibition against establishment, whereas the free exercise clause, that makes sense to me, that there's a compelling state interest could override the particular person's free exercise of his or her religion. So I was startled when the talk of a compelling state interest began to appear in these establishment clause jurisdictions. And I said, what's this doing here? It's associated with the free exercise clause.
We've got now about four questions lined up. Would you like to take them separately, or can I cluster a few together?
Well, if they relate to...
Okay, let's try it. So I have Robert, and then you, and then you, and then Ashley, and Wendell, five. So go ahead, Robert, please.
Professor, you focused very heavily on the Constitution of the United States as the fundamental source of law in the subject matter that you've addressed, and made the distinction between citizens and aliens, lawful and unlawful combatants. What about the human rights instruments to which the United States is a party, and which, under the Constitution of the United States, once the United States accedes to them, become, quote, the supreme law of the land, end quote? To what extent are these, such as the Convention Against Torture, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, relevant to the subject matter that you have addressed? In other words, to what extent do they confer rights inasmuch as the instruments have become the supreme law of the land in the United States on the individuals that you have been discussing?
Well, as you know, Congress has to act to enforce these treaties, which it has done in the case of torture. Maybe you could argue that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is an enforcement. There has to be a statute. Maybe you could argue that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a way of enforcing UN, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
The declaration has no legal force. I'm referring specifically to international human rights treaties to which the United States is a party, and which therefore, by virtue of that fact, become the supreme law of the land under the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about treaties specifically.
Yes, human rights treaties.
But are there any treaties that deal with the subject of religion?
Well, I would say the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights does address that subject, yes.
Is the United States a party to that?
Yes, yes.
International Covenant?
Yes.
Against
yes,
Clinton.
Is.
Clinton.
So that is binding on the United States.
But has Congress then acted to enforce that treaty by domestic legislation?
That's another matter. But that is precisely my question. By virtue of the fact that they become the supreme law of the land as the Constitution is written, how do you interpret that particular phrase and the rights it therefore would confer, the human rights it would therefore confer on the individuals you have been discussing?
I think under United States law, there has to be a domestic legislation to enforce the treaty. That's my view. I'm not an expert on international law. Maybe the supreme law of the land in a theoretical sense, but the courts won't enforce it unless it's a statute has been passed. So confirmation of by the Senate is not enough of the treaty. The whole Congress has to pass a statute to enforce the treaty. Somebody may know more about this than I do.
Okay, well, let's go, please, because we have a few more questions. So,
Professor, I'm the President of the United States, and I have a complete different view of things, and I've hired you as my legal consultant. I have a couple of problems I want you to address up front. First, I've got a leader in Iraq named Dave Petraeus, and Dave has advised me, and I think it's good advice, that he needs to reach out to, and he wants a substantial budget to work with the religious communities there, the Sunnis and the Shias, which by definition would leave minorities out, but covers at least 95%, because Kurds are fundamentally Sunnis, not all of them. And I just want to know if I need any advice from you, if there are any legal tensions out there, including, but certainly not limited to the Constitution, that I need to be mindful of as I expend money, which clearly will be highlighting some religions and not others. And the second thing I've got is I've got this nonprofit organization that has set up help and aid to bring secular education into madrasas, they want money from the USAID or any other U.S. taxpayer source, and I think it's a great idea because I think that's getting to the root of the problem as President of the United States. And I just want to know if you see any problems I have with either one of those and what kind of advice I need, and whether I need to spend a lot of money on your advice or you can just give me a quick answer.
Okay, before you go ahead, Professor, let's just say for those who may listen on the podcast, this isn't really the president, okay?
I'm relieved. I'm relieved. Well, in my DePaul article, I emphasize the fact, or I draw a distinction between the fact of whether the United States is going it alone or is accepting a policy of, let's say, a functioning independent Iraqi government. And there's the topic of comity among sovereign nations comes in. In the regard to the facts of the situation, if you treat Iraq as a sovereign nation, and recall I questioned that, whether it is, should be considered such. But if you treat it as a independent sovereign nation and you want to, the United States has to face this fact that Iraq is primarily a Muslim country. And this may be where the Establishment Clause could come in, the compelling state interest could come in through the back door, because the foreign policy interests of the United States, given that Iraq is predominantly a Muslim country and its government is tilting toward Islam, that's a fact. And if we have to deal with them, we should be able to deal with them. But I draw this distinction in the DePaul article between are we going it alone? That's our idea. And that's our idea that we should deal with these Muslim organizations and provide aid for them. And I wrote a later article on the is the United States entitled constitutionally to support moderate Islam around the world, which you could not support a particular theology in the United States. But can you support moderate Islam outside the United States? That's a difficult question. Here you are promoting a particular religious belief, and let's say the United States had this idea we're acceding to Saudi Arabia's request that we support moderate Islam, though that's most improbable because of the Wahhabi influence. But Iraq might want us to support moderate Islam to reduce the threat of terrorism. So I'm seeing a difference where the United States, as I say, got the idea, and it's its policy versus going along with another country's genuinely independent sovereign country's idea, its policy. Not quite,
because I'm just going to say that the Iraqi government in that hypothetical agrees to pay 50 cents on a dollar, so implicit in that, they're fully on board, and the madrasas are in Pakistan, and Pakistan also will pay 50% of the cost. Does that change your question at all, or can I get a clear go, no go from you on that one?
Would a lawyer give a clear go? Mr. Wu.
I'm not paying you here, Professor.
Professor Wu got in a lot of trouble.
Sorry, I still have a few more questions. So maybe, was your question related to this? Okay, so can you introduce yourself? Because you came in a little later, and we all and also please push the red button, because we're recording all of this. So if this is related.
I may not ask the question then. My name is Kate Howard, and I've been a consultant in Afghanistan and other Islamic countries. And the question I have, the curious, when you actually face it in the weeds, and you're in country and it's confronting to you, it puts you in a quandary, and you really just have to deal with it from a security perspective, or an efficiency pragmatic perspective. But here's an example, hypothetical example. Fully USAID funded program. Everything that is being done within this program is completely paid for by USAID. You are actually you're an implementer, a contract implementer, and your implementer is a hypothetical, not a nonprofit, not a faith-based profit, but a state university, land-grant university in the United States. And your 24 Islamic staff members very much want you to open up every meeting that you do with a prayer. And you have to work around Ramadan. Do you allow your staff to your non-Muslim staff to drink water while you're celebrating Ramadan? Or do you say, no, I'm sorry, this is a USAID project, and you know, we really can't open our meetings with prayers here. And I don't know where in the this is a weeds example of way far away from the Constitution, and you're sitting in Kabul or Kandahar or Mazar-e Sharif trying to figure out what's best. Quite frankly, I deal with it pragmatically and I just swallow my separation of church and state, because it's more important for me to get the long-term objectives of the programs. But I actually never did know where I actually fell in within the law. And sometimes it's better not to ask.
Well, I mean, it's a very good point you raise. And at the previous meeting, we had an army officer who, in Iraq, wanted to support an imam in a mosque, and he was a moderate imam, and they were worried he would go either way. So he went to the embassy and asked if he could support it, and they said, no, it's a church-state issue. We can't support religion. So then he went back, and he said, oh, I'm sorry, it's a cultural center, and I'm supporting a cultural center. And then, therefore, the embassy said, yes, you can get money. I mean, these are the types of complications we're really trying to untangle in these meetings. So thank you for that example. Can I just go to the next question, and then we're sorry to be... Yeah, no, that's it. People are dealing with those issues. Sir, please.
Professor, I'm curious. Do you think the scope of the Establishment Clause ought to depend on this analysis of whether the right is fundamental or not when its Establishment Clause is granted other rights are phrased this way too, but it's phrased as a limitation on what the government can do, and you can argue that it doesn't protect just the person on the ground where the spending program at issue might operate, but also the taxpayers back in this country. So I'm curious whether you think that's an appropriate way to analyze the extraterritorial effect of the Establishment Clause. I mean, there's a sense in which there's an action of government, even if the program is as far away as Siberia, the money is still coming from, the United States Treasury.
Yeah.
And ought that really determine it?
there's endless controversy about the relationship between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. And every Establishment Clause case you could see as a Free Exercise Clause case, because the taxpayers are... money is being extracted from their pockets to support a religion that they don't believe in. So But that's where I come forward with this idea of the free exercise clause. The free exercise idea historically preceded. You could have an established church, people compelled to pay taxes to support that established church. That didn't violate, from a historical point of view, didn't violate the free exercise of religion, where you had to pay. It's only money, the Massachusetts court said. It was only money in the early 19th century. What you got to do, because they were used to criminal punishment for conducting unlawful religious services. So it was a contrast what they were what they used to. So I seize upon that idea as before the Smith came down and they deprived me of this argument. I seize it on the free exercise is a more fundamental and takes a harsher burden on the rather than simply the extraction of money from you. Maybe the extraction of money could be prohibitive. In other words, if it takes so much money from you, you couldn't function in another, you couldn't organize another religious service. But I'm struggling for a distinction between more fundamental protection, active persecution, or somewhat less protection of religious liberty. And so when you add into the extraterritorial dimension, that makes it more complicated because it brings in the comity issue, which I've tried to emphasize in the insular cases. You encounter a different culture, including a different legal culture, and you have to accept that fact, but don't accept it entirely. Let's say, I really think this preaching moderate Islam is puts it to you. You're supporting. And that's where I get it. Is it your idea to support moderate Islam? You're supporting a particular theology, a particular view of God, which is rather startling because you couldn't do that in the United States. You couldn't support moderate Islam in the United States. Can you do it abroad? But that may trench upon the more fundamental idea, this distinction I'm trying to draw between what's really important in the core of religious liberty and what's peripheral, not significant, but peripheral.
Though I'm suggesting perhaps that's not the right frame to use. Spend somewhat attention to the proposition that the exception clause is a rather inflexible limitation on what government can do and ought not be bounded by these governmental interests, which in this case often would be compelling foreign policy interests that would be very compelling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that may be why the compelling interest state test has appeared in the establishment clause analysis.
Okay, we have three more questions. So Ashley, Wendell, and then Shannon, and then we'll have to close it because we're already keeping the professor longer than we promised him. So please, Ashley.
Thanks. Professor, I just wanted to push a little bit on your notion that Munaf tells us anything about the extraterritorial application of the Constitution. I had thought that in that case there's actually a footnote by the court that says that it's purely a statutory decision and is not trying to reach constitutional issues. Plus, further, as you noted in their part about whether the U.S. is precluded from transferring people to the Iraqis in the face of potential torture issues, the majority held 9-0 that it was not going to take on that issue, that, in fact, there's this principle called the rule of non-inquiry that basically says that courts won't look at the potential fair trials or treatment of people who are transferred, that that's an executive branch decision. So I wanted to sort of see how you'd respond to a couple of those points.
Well, didn't Munaf claim a constitutional right not to be turned over? The statutory issue, the statute, the habeas corpus statute, applied to his case. And he had a right under the statute. But didn't he claim, I think he claimed a constitutional right not to be turned over to the Iraqis?
Well, I guess my point is then the court didn't take that up, and so implicitly must have concluded that that issue didn't raise a sort of cognizable claim. And I'd have to reread the Souter concurrence to see what he said, whether he raised potential constitutional bars to that transfer or not. But it seems like if Munaf and Omar did raise that constitutional claim, the court didn't accept that as a viable claim.
He made a constitutional claim, but it didn't sustain the constitutional claim. But he at least made a constitutional claim. And the earlier cases they relied upon related to they were turning him over to Japan in the case. An American soldier had allegedly murdered a woman in Japan, but that was murder. They turned him over to be prosecuted for murder. Or in the other case, whose name has slipped my mind, was turning an embezzlement case. They were turning him over to be prosecuted for embezzlement. That's where if they turned him over to be prosecuted for blasphemy, and that's why I'm emphasizing the torture, focusing on the torture discussion, which seemed to me to come pretty close to active persecution on grounds of religion. So I may be wrong. I think in the Munaf case, there was a constitutional claim, and they had to decide that constitutional claim, and they decided it against him. He had no constitutional right not to be turned over to the Iraqis for prosecution for unlawful insurgency, right? Whereas my argument would be, even if he's an alien, and that's all outside the United States, he would have a constitutional right not to be turned over for prosecution for blasphemy.
Okay, these are incredibly complicated and rich. Wendell, please, and then...
First of all, thank you for inducing me to read the Boumediene decision as far as I've gotten. It's just really the majority opinion. It raises some interesting questions. I want to take you in a different direction and draw on your expertise in the area of the rules and principles of evidence. It seems to me that in the Boumediene opinion, and also in a recent D.C. Circuit opinion that dealt with a Guantanamo detainee from a Uyghur from China, that the courts are motivated, perhaps, are forced to deal with issues that of fundamental fairness, whether you get to it through habeas or due process or what have you, that there are systems that are involved, either from the U.S. military or abroad, that are not capable of getting to the facts. Do you see an extraterritorial application, either in existence or potentially, of applying basic standards of due process, of getting in both either the Guantanamo context or international applications? In other words, if we were faced with a situation where, you know, in one of the cases that was cited in Boumediene, there was a consular system for dealing with criminal activities in Tokyo.
but the court seemed to think that it worked pretty well and that was okay. They also seemed to think that the Guantanamo context, there really weren't safeguards, and that's why, I mean, if you read through it, and if you read the failure of the political branches to deal with this, that's when the court stepped in. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, in the Guantanamo case, the Boumediene case, they first decide Congress violated the suspension clause by providing an inadequate substitute for the historically shaped writ of habeas corpus. But then they went on to decide these people have substantive or procedural constitutional rights. What they are, there's a kind of interplay here. Combatant status review tribunals and so forth, combined with the D.C. Circuit's involvement in there, which is a limited review, they flunk. The constitutional requirement. Whatever has to go on in the combatant status review thing has to be different. And they cite the hearsay rule. These tribunals are allowed to rely upon hearsay. They don't have access to classified information and so forth. So that clearly flunks. Whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, you can use hearsay in preliminary determinations about preliminary sortings out of who's a illegal combatant and who is a lawful combatant, supposed to be classified as a Probably my answer would be yes. You have to take into account the practicalities of the situation and what's all happening so fast there. So, but when you get to Guantanamo, now it seems you have to provide due process, right? Because it's out of the war zone. It's really in the United States de facto. The United States has complete jurisdiction over it, complete power over it. Am I answering your question? You're talking about the rules of evidence, right?
Well, I guess what I'm really getting at is a little bit of, because the case is fascinating, and they distinguish several cases here. Mm-hmm. But is there a right to, what is the standard for due process that's applied extraterritorially? In other words, they said if it's an Allied prison in Germany after the Second World War, there are considerations that go in the other direction. If it's Guantanamo, where the U.S. has exclusive control, but it seems to me that it's a factually driven decision to some extent, that there is a disbelief that evidence is being used fairly and accurately. And again, in this D.C. Circuit opinion recently, they cited Lewis Carroll and David Sintel, who'd been on the opposite side of some of these issues a few years ago, joined in the opinion of the court, where they simply do not believe that the U.S. government is being truthful or is providing reliable evidence.
Okay, we have one more question, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Shannon, please, and then we'll close up.
Well, one of the key findings in our research so far has been that people in the field really are having a lot of confusion about some of these issues, and I think the lady in the back who asked those questions about Afghanistan, those are really important issues, and there's a sense of nervousness about what can I do and what can't I do and what should I be doing. Mm-hmm. What has your experience with this been? What kind of legal guidance can we give people? The questions clearly still exist, so...
Precious little. Would that we were clear. Would that we would be clearer on these points. I'm here to raise questions, right? But I pity the military lawyers who have to make decisions in specific confusing circumstances. I'm only a mere professor.
Well, on that note, we'd like to really thank you for helping to tease out some of these really difficult and thorny questions for us, and we hope you can stay involved with us as we are trying to push for greater clarity with or without Supreme Court decisions to guide us. So thank you again.